This is the Impact Report. I'm your host, Katie Ullman. The Impact Report brings together students and faculty in Bard College's MBA in Sustainability program with leaders in business, sustainability, finance, social entrepreneurship, and more. These conversations go live the first and third Friday of each month. This week, I'm joined by Anthony Osijo, Chief Financial Officer of Bbox.
Anthony joined the Bbox team in 2021 at a time of significant momentum, as the company has scaled by forging strategic partnerships with investors, governments, and major corporations like EDF and Mitsubishi. We are excited to have Anthony on the Impact Report.
Thank you for having me.
So I guess I would like to start at the very beginning. And quite simply, what is Bbox? What's the meaning behind the name? How does it transform lives? Basically, if you could start at the beginning and tell me everything.
Okay. Well, my story with Bbox is actually quite interesting. So I probably, as you said, start at the beginning. So about 16 years ago, I met these three young men who were students at Imperial College and who were running. We met at an event. In fact, I was a judge on a panel, and they were presenting their project, their third year project. And they were running an electricity project in Rwanda. Yeah, as you can imagine, they're third year students at Imperial. And they were looking at electrifying and providing access to electricity for people who couldn't actually get it or who couldn't afford it in Rwanda. And you've got to remember that this, I think it was about 2008, 2009, was at a point where Hotel Rwanda, as a movie, had just come out. And from a Western perspective, Rwanda was just seen as a no-go kind of area. And I was just amazed that these three 19-year-old guys were so interested in doing something in a region that was deemed to be dangerous, but were really risking their lives trying to bring energy, clean energy, to people at that point in time. So I asked them to come see me in the office, because at that point in time, I think they were trying to raise about 40,000 just to fund their charity, to fund the organization they had, which was called Equinox then. And I suggested to the guy who's now become the CEO, Mansour Amin, that, you know, I wasn't really interested in charities, but if they were going to run this as an organization, then I would look at supporting them, and I would also, you know, support them, not just from a monetary perspective, but from a coaching kind of perspective. And I thought that was the last of it, right? And then a few months later, Mansour came back to see me, came back with the guys, showed with their first Bbox and their first production, which was still produced as students. And it was this battery box, what looked like a battery box, right? It was just square and not very rudimentary, but lo and behold, you plugged a bulb into it and lights came on. And this is what they were being able to, and there was a little solar panel on the top of it. And basically you put that out in sun, and in effect it stored enough power, and that became something that they were able to sell to people at a relatively cheap price. And I said, look, they were looking at making this an organization, and I was like, okay, you know, I'm in. And I became one of the, and they had a number of angel investors at the time. So I think they were raising a very, in today's terms, very small amount of money. But I got in there. And then I also became, Mansour asked me to be one of their only first non-executive director to actually put some years on the clock in terms of when they were looking to go out to develop the company. So I stayed on an advisory role, just talking to them quarterly and trying to help the business through in the first few years. But it was really just at that point in time for me, it was just something interesting with some very intriguing guys. And that was, yeah. And then we met again when they finished school. I moved out to work as deputy head for Asia for Crédit Agricole in Asia. And they'd finished university. Their first, Mansour's first job was with Rolls-Royce out in Asia. We happened to meet there. I was working there for Crédit Agricole, and he was there working for Rolls-Royce. And we had various other conversations while we're out there. And he was basically trying to decide whether, because Bbox was still a bit of a hobby, a side job for him at the time. And I was like, look, you know, this is the time to do what you want to. You're young. There's no downside risk. And he then, off the back of that, and I presume other people's advice as well, he decided to concentrate on that full time. And that was in 2011, 2012. And then serendipitously, and we kept in contact. So they developed a factory in China. I think in 2014, I went across to see the factory in China, supported them through their Series A round intellectually and also from an advisory perspective, and then sort of left them to do their own thing. And then I think sometime in 2019, we used to meet up for dinner sort of once or twice a year. Mansoor came to my house and said, came to my house with his partner. We had dinner and then basically said, I was at that point in time, I was just about leaving investment banking. I wanted to set up my own thing because I'd done 28 years in investment banking. And then he was like, oh, could you come in one day a week just to help us look at some stuff around the financing side of things? We've just raised a decent amount of money in our Series D. Would you come along and can you just come and help us take us to the next stage? It will be half a day a week. And your experience will be really, you know, we need somebody we can trust. And I went along and that was, I remember it was December the 6th, 2019. I went along the following week to have a look. And, you know, 4 years later or 3.5 years later, I'm still in there full time. It's become a passion. The work that we're doing is absolutely amazing in terms of giving back, but it's also having a real sustainable impact on people's lives in Africa. So that's a long-winded way of answering. I didn't found the company, but I feel like an adjunct founder. I've been along with them from even before, along with them from before Beebox, so I know exactly what they've actually gone through. And in terms of, as I probably alluded to in the discussion there, Beebox actually means battery box. And so that was what somebody called it as one of the stages we're talking about it. And just in terms of, you know, that is exactly where we started from. We started from a box that was a battery, and it's grown into a lot wider things. And we thought that the name was catchy, or they thought the name was catchy. The name was resonated, and that became our brand name.
Well, that makes sense that it is, it's a great name. It's easy to remember and it does encapsulate the work that you're doing. Would you be able to talk a little bit more about the technology? So it started initially with the actual Beebox. How has the technology evolved since the beginning and what services are you providing now?
So, I mean, one of the questions that everyone had was, how do you provide energy to people who don't have access to energy, but who have an affordability issue?
Yeah.
Right. Now, trying to provide them with electricity from the grid was too expensive because the grid is really expensive and they didn't have the means to pay for it. But one of the things that was really available in Africa, which is the sun. There's a lot of sun. So then it's case, how do you channel the solar energy into a tool that then allows you to distributed in an economically viable manner, where when we were first looking at this, it was very difficult to do so because these guys didn't have cash. The banking facilities didn't really help because most of them didn't have bank accounts. And some of the first things that we tried, which where people had to go and collect cash manually, were also fraught with risk. Yeah. So the advent of mobile money has really helped the industry boom, right? So using mobile phone technology to remit money. So the advent of things like M-Pesa in East Africa have helped change the industry and make it more affordable for everyone, right? But also one of the things that we have is proprietary technology, which allows us, which we're able to, we call a super highway, which is proprietary technology that which we associate with all of our boxes or all of our batteries, all of our control units, which allows us to more or less remote control those batteries, right? So we can look at every control unit that we put in place from a remote perspective from London or China and actually identify in most cases If there's a fault, we can repair the fault remotely, right? Which makes it more economically viable. Yeah. What we're also able to do using the mobile money is to be able to receive payments remotely. So that means, again, we don't have to go around collecting money. The money is just channeled via the platform into our bank account. And we receive over a million, sometimes over a million payments a month. So it's a lot of, as you can, yes, because people can pay the equivalent of 20 cents or 20p on a daily basis to get access to energy. Also, in terms of control, what we're all we put in place is what is called in the industry a pay-go technology. So people pay for electricity as they need it. So we're able to switch on or switch off the electricity remotely because we have access to the battery or to the box in itself, to the control unit, remotely. And subject to people paying, then the box gets switched on. So it's what is called in the industry also a pay-go technology. So let's say you want to go on holiday for 2 weeks. Not that these people go on holiday, but let's say they want to move to go and visit a relative or something happened in another village and they don't need the electricity, then they don't have to pay for it because they're not there. Obviously, the box will not work because it's switched off during that duration because they haven't paid for it. But it's a real, the advancement of technology has allowed us to be able to deploy that in a cost-effective manner. It also works for them because they can also pay. And the other part of that, which is in the news quite a bit, is that as some of this is also a societal issue, we also work with governments to make sure that we have policies in place for the hardest to reach or the hardest to people who have biggest difficulty in being able to afford these, to make sure that they put in place as well government subsidies to help encourage these people to be able to afford access to energy. And then what that also opens up is it's not just access to energy. What we then have now is, you know, we have over 500,000 live customers right now. One of the things that we have off the back of that is we have performance history, credit history. So where we see that certain people can have the ability to do more than, let's say, just a basic unit, we can also offer them incremental services. So they can go from just having, let's say, four lamps to having a TV, to having a fridge, to having other amenities which actually help improve their lives. We have also expanded now into e-mobility, where we're applying the same technology to motorbikes. So there's other ways of improving lives because that also gives another source of income. We have done things like shavers, for example, which people have opened businesses with. We have given people radios and TVs. We've done things like irons. We've done fans, which are quite important. We've also done for the agricultural sector. We've also gone into what we call into the water pump side of things, and that has helped improve, the economic viability of farms, but it's also improved the lives of farmers no end, right? We've also done joint ventures with people like who provide cable television, so like DSTV, or in the French countries, Canal Plus. So you now give people access to channels that they wouldn't have. And I remember I was in Togo in a village with one of our partners recently, and it was quite heartwarming to go into a little hut in the village, see the farmer who says, he's improved his efficiency by over 60%, but his three children were sat on the bed in their hut, which was only one room, right, watching Canal Plus, watching things like Scooby-Doo and Scrappy-Doo. But what was really important was the education these kids were getting just by watching this, in terms of they were watching it in French, they were not watching it in their local language. So they were obviously already learning a secondary language, but also learning things that their parents didn't have the ability to learn via just putting in place this technology, which the educational ability of having in place these things or where we can provide additional learning was something that made all of the journey quite worthwhile.
Yeah, I mean, there's just so much there. And it's really VBOX seems incredibly transformative, not just for the individuals whose lives are changing as a result of it, but also just in industry. Power is so expensive for no matter where you live. And it also, especially in the West, is mostly provided through the burning of fossil fuels still. So something I wanted to just back up a little bit about was to find out specifically, you know, what countries and municipalities you're operating in. And then if you could just, you know, how does a household get a VBOX? How does that work? How can they access this technology?
That's a great question, and thank you for that. I think VBOX is in 10 countries right now in Africa, which it makes it one of the largest providers of solar energy across Pan-Africa. So we're in West Africa, in Ivory Coast, Senegal, Ghana, Mali, Burkina Faso, Nigeria, right? So we're in those countries there. And then we're in, and Togo as well. And then we're in East Africa, in DRC, in Rwanda, and in Kenya. So our oldest markets are Kenya. Well, we started off in Rwanda. So our regional head office is in Rwanda. As I said, the story started in Rwanda. So our regional head office is in Rwanda, and we have a passion for Rwanda, having helped develop, worked in lockstep with the government in terms of developing their off-grid policy as well, and been there as one of the largest and in fact one of the best, one, you know, best company to work for in Rwanda a while back. We're also in Kenya, so we have over 130,000 connections in Kenya right now, so customers, live customers. And as you can imagine, over the PAYGO period, after about 3 years, people get to own their kits. So oh, wow. I'm talking about live connections right now. So I think the way we look at it is that we say that VBOX has impacted over 3 million lives over the course of its existence. Because basically you multiply, if you take each household and you multiply it by four, for example, and say four people are living in that household, then that's sort of like how we look at it. We tend to focused a lot in the past on the rural areas. So again, trying to end energy poverty. We're not averse to working in the urban areas and the larger spaces and the commerce and industry kind of spaces. But our focus has really been on ending energy poverty. And on ending energy poverty, it basically means that we've had to go to where the problem is. And one of the things that you addressed there, which is really interesting and really important, is that most people don't realize that the grid is subsidized. None of us, even in the West, can afford to pay for our energy on the grid. All of us in the first world, or maybe it's not politically correct to say first world anymore, but in the developed nations benefit from subsidized energy. And we're all screaming at the moment because some of the subsidies have been removed and the cost of living has gone crazy, especially here in the UK, for example, because of the fuel prices as a result of some of the stuff that's happening with, further on in the East. So it's quite important that people should understand that energy provision is something that requires capital, it requires funding, but it also requires involvement of the governments, because the guys who are on the grid are all subsidized. So why would you think that poor people who can't afford energy shouldn't have a right to energy and shouldn't have a right to be involved in the government subsidy? In fact, these are the people that really should have access to impact more than anyone else.
I agree with that. Beyond energy, food, everything.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's not a charity. I was speaking in an event last week. I think people should understand that access to energy, access to electricity, access to food should be a human right, not a discretionary right to whether you're rich or poor, right? It's everyone should be entitled to have access to light, should have access to an education and should have access to clean energy, clean water, and a right to live.
And everything you're saying is sparking another question, but I know we have limited time, but you did touch upon this slightly there. It is not a charity. And, you know, if you speak with most people that are the recipients of so-called charity, they're not looking for a handout. They just want to be able to provide for their families and have productive lives. So as you know, based on the work that you're doing, investment in African tech startups passed US $3 billion last year. This is a record number. So there's a lot at stake potentially, and potentially a lot of money to be made. In the US, there's often stories in the West of, you know, well-intentioned people going to Africa and trying to, you know, save people. So you touched upon it more, but I would love to hear how BBOX is not, because it isn't, another example of savior syndrome.
And that's again, I think it's a very fundamental, and we could spend an hour just going through that. You know, it's a very loaded question. The thing is, as yeah, and this is, it's actually quite an, it's quite a personal question for me as well, because this is one of the first things I said to the guys when I first met them. It's like, look, Africa has enough charities, right? If you want to run this as a sustainable business. And then there is support and try and grow it. The fact is that is a challenge in itself, because how to run a sustainable business in terms of how we look at stuff from the West, it has to be profitable. The question is, how do you make profit from poor people, right? And there is a bit of a paradox in that, in terms of how we look at that. And one of my passions, for example, is to look at how we look at rewarding impact in ways that are more than just monetary, right? Because if you're looking at it from a poor person's perspective, you look at it and go, I need to make profit. To make profit from poor people takes a lot of time and a lot of build, and you have to invest a lot. And quite often the West gets fatigued, right? Because you put money in, but you're waiting, it's, you know, when it's poor people, you need a lot of time to grow traction. So you need 5 years, it's a 5-10 years, and the more you grow, right? Because there's just so many people. One of the numbers that was thrown out last week was that to fully electrify the 600 million people who don't have access to energy right now would probably cost about $43 billion. Right now, people can throw out statistics whichever way they want to. Even if you look at it from a simple viewpoint of, let's say $200 a unit, 600 million times 200 is 12 billion. To do 10% of that is 1.2 billion. To do 1% of that is 120 million, right? And to do 0.1% of that is 12 million. So whichever number you look at, as people get fatigued, go, well, to do 1% and spend 120 million, should I really do anything, or am I better buying a jet, right? and that, you know, but the answer is that we have to start somewhere, and we have to do things incrementally, and we have to have little wins. But we also have to look at ways of rewarding people for saving lives, for making a difference. One of the things that we do need to look at is how we can report really reward impact in a better way. What is the cost of saving a life? We, you know, there would have been no movement on the sustainability agenda if we hadn't brought into play carbon credits. Right, because now with carbon credits, which took a long time to implement and to get people sensitized to, has now become a way for rewarding investment in the environment. Because otherwise, investing in an environment is more expensive in monetary terms than you really save. It's easier to burn fossil fuels sometimes than it is to do other things. But because we've now got a process in place which rewards people with carbon credits with a tangible measure, people now look at trading carbon credits, and you can reward carbon credits, and carbon credits have a monetary value. So if you can do that for the environment, one of my questions is, what price a human life, right? And what value do we put on that? And is saving a human life or providing education to somebody or providing access to energy to somebody, does that not have a value that we should ascribe a number to? Because if we can do that, right, where people are measured on, you know, oh, not just on, well, I made $200 this week, but actually I impacted 200 lives, and I saved 200 lives, people from penury or from disease, and that has a value to it, right? Then that becomes a more powerful tool for us to use. The industry isn't there yet, and there have been a number of papers that have been written on it, and we're pushing it from our perspective as well, because we believe that a financial measure on itself is not a fair measure for impact. Right, then that becomes something that, you know, and it maybe it's something that we talk about on another podcast, so, but it really is a detailed thing where I do think the world needs to look at how to reward impact in better ways. Otherwise, impact is regarded as charity, and charity is seen as something that makes you, gives you a reward in another life, but it really isn't sustainable. But an impact credit, a credit, a way of measuring things which gives you a tangible reward for doing something that you actually know that you should do, would give companies a lot of incentive to do stuff. Alternatively, we do the others, you know, we, in terms of raising funding, we raise funds from a lot of DFIs. We've had a lot of support. There was an announcement in the press today from BGFA where we've been awarded a facility in Burkina Faso to help our work there. There are a lot of institutions that are out there that are helping with the process. But I go back to my, or to a point I made earlier, there's 600 million people for us to get to. There's between 12 and 40 billion that's required. 5 million, 10 million here or there isn't really going to move the needle. And as when you have, or when you're an investment fund, when you have other areas to invest, like investing in the US or investing in Finland, or where you have a safer return, it, you know, you're competing with other safer investments for a limited pool. So we have to think outside the box. We have to, this problem isn't going to go away. Bbox, with its technology and with its desire and its drive and having been around for 14 years, is a key player in this industry, and we want to continue to be so. But the industry needs help, and it needs what I would call out of the box thinking.
A couple of things came up from me during your answer, and one of them has to do with the need for the services and the desire to, you know, implement them, and it's great. So are there other competitors or operators that are working in the same space that you think, as an ecosystem of providers, you could get there?
I think there's a general willingness to get there. I think the size of the problem is huge. There is still concentration in what I would call the safe areas. So, you know, in places like Kenya, Rwanda, you know, where there are, where there's infrastructure in place. A lot of the more needing places for access are places where there is conflict, because as you can imagine, where conflict has happened, places have been destroyed, access to the grid. The grid is the first thing that tends to go when there's a war. Post that war, a lot of money is needed. We're in places that are deemed, we're in Mali, for example. Mali's had its trials in the last few years. We're in Burkina Faso, it's had its trials in the last few years. There's a need to do stuff in sub-Saharan, places like Sudan, places like South Sudan, places like Niger, where there are people, and you know, a lot of people that don't actually make the headlines because they're too dangerous to go to, according to, you know, our country's foreign officers. So, you know, they're not, people don't talk about them, but there's a huge element of, like I said, there's 600 million people in sub-Saharan Africa that don't have access to energy. Even with all of us as you know, whether it's ourselves, whether it's GLP, whether it's, as you know, whether it's Solapanda, whether it's Engie, whether it's any of the big five that we actually have, we probably cover between us 1% of the TAM, right? If we've covered 6 million out of the 600 million between us, we're doing extremely well. So the size of the market, it's one of those markets that's huge, but requires funding and access to capital to scale. And to be able to break even, you need to get to size. So the simple answer to your question is, we've done a lot. There's a lot more to be done.
How does that play out in your fundraising? So obviously the company has been around for over a decade. And I'm compelled, the story is compelling and the need is compelling. How does that play out in fundraising?
It's difficult. Fundraising is difficult. We have a lot of support from the impact investors. The difficulty as well is getting funding from the people with a lot of money, which is the venture capitalists. Because going back to the point that I raised before, the venture capitalists look at it from a yield perspective. And as an ex-investment banker, I totally understand that. Right, that's what I would have looked at myself as a bank. Is like, okay, the numbers don't add up, or the numbers take too long to add up. And I compare with investing in a donut factory in Holland, and I can make my money easier in a donut factory or donut in a Dunkin', some donut establishment in Europe. So why would I take the risk and put money in Burkina Faso when I can easily put the money in Holland or Denmark and make the same, if not better, return. Right? And that's how investment bankers or investors think, right? They're not emotional. It's a case of where's the money? And therefore, as long as we're just looking at this as from a money play, from a return on investment play, there will always be somewhere safer or deemed safer where you would be able to get a better return. And that's where the competition is. Mm-hmm. So then you look at the specialist funds or the specialist investors who want to invest in Africa or who want to invest in impact. But even they are very choosy, right? And they want to invest, a lot of the time they want to invest in long-term government projects where it's secured by the World Bank or secured by the government. So their risk is protected,
mm-hmm.
right? And you can plan on that. But when you look at it from an off-grid perspective, the sector is relatively young. The credit is relatively low grade. So, and the countries are all on, various watch lists or various gray zone lists or various, political infractions. So don't go there kind of lists. So people say polite, people look at it. There's a lot of looking at it. And there's lots of polite declines around things. But as somebody who's been on that side of the fence, I totally understand why. And I probably would have made the same decisions myself. But that doesn't solve the problems that we have and the issues that we have, which are still there. So we are continuously working on how to close that funding gap. And it's not, there's no easy answer to that. It's work in progress. We need more understanding. We need people to put their money where their mouth is. We need people to understand that what it requires is patient capital. And that, one of the things that I always find a bit perverse is the fact that because people charge a risk premium for investing in the South-South, so the global South being Africa, South America, Southeast Asia, to cover the political risk, the fact is, if I was investing in something in, let's say, Denmark, I probably should be charging a blended interest rate of maybe 5% or 6% for a project.
Mm-hmm.
If you come to doing the same issue in, in Malawi, which has maybe half the chance in Denmark of succeeding, the numbers are tighter, I probably get charged 30%, a blended cost. Blended cost means the financing cost, including the legal cost, including the facility. So you're already starting at, you're starting your marathon 25 steps behind.
At a huge deficit compared.
As a huge deficit. And then you're penalized when you actually don't make it because that then becomes an example as why I shouldn't invest in it again. And it almost becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, which is why, you know, I have one hand tied behind my back and my toes strapped together, and then I'm penalized for not winning a race with a full-bodied person. So those are the conundrum that we have to resolve. Again, there's lots of people working on it, but it's not an easy solution.
No, it isn't. Oh, wow. I wish we had another hour, but we don't. How can listeners and investors learn more about BBOX and just support this, the journey of ending energy poverty? I mean, just that statement alone is incredibly huge.
If you want to learn more about BBOX, Google is everybody's friend. Type in. We have a lot of one of the things that we try to do is push awareness quite a bit. We have our website, www.bbox.co.uk, www.bbox.com. But again, just type in BBOX into Google. It will come up on lots of searches. If investors want to look at investing in this, please reach out to me, or reach out to our contact side by the website or directly on LinkedIn. I'm more than happy to talk to, engage with anyone who is seriously, yes, LinkedIn as well, who wants to engage in this. We need you. We need people to be engaged in this. It's not a problem that BBOX alone are going to fix. It's a problem that we all are responsible for. And what people need to understand is, with the advent of technology also shows everybody else what their life should be. So the fastest growing technology in Africa, or even in the global south, is access to smartphones and mobile phones, which basically means that people, TikTok, the YouTube, they can see what life is meant to be like. So they see the lives that we live in the West, and they want those lives. So either we bring it to them, or they'll come and they'll sacrifice their lives trying to get it. Right? And that's why we have other problems, you know, without trying to scaremonger. That's why we have other problems around immigration and various other things. So I think it's incumbent on anyone who wants to do this to reach out. It's like I said, I was meant to be doing this one day a week, and it's now become my life, right? So I'm in it fully immersed. And it's extremely noble. It's extremely doable. And the impact on people's lives. And I'll probably end up by saying that, you know, one of the best days of my life was actually going into Togo, standing with this farmer and listening to him say in French that the best day of his life was when he met an agent who was selling him the BBOX product, and it's transformed his whole family, his whole life. And, you know, and basically, you know, he's totally in a different place. And that alone brought a little tear to my eye. And I thought, you know what, this is good work.
Well, I can't think of a better way to end this conversation. Thank you so much, Anthony, for joining me this morning. I'll be sure to be following along with your journey.
Thank you very much, Katie. And a great pleasure. And like I said, this is a passion. So if you ever want to expand on it, I'm happy to spend time doing that.
Appreciate our loyal Impact Report listeners, and hope you can help us spread the word about the series and the important sustainability work of our guests. Please rate and review the Impact Report wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you were inspired by this conversation, share a screenshot on Instagram and tag Impact Report Podcast. BBOX by visiting them at bbox.com. That's BBOXX.com. Join us for season 7 of the Impact Report beginning later this summer. The lineup includes guests from MidiMap, Up Up Chocolate, Ernst & Young, and the American Sustainable Business Network. Impact Purpose. purpose-driven career in sustainability? Check out the resources page from the Bard Graduate Programs in Sustainability for access to free resources to jumpstart your career. Hear from leaders in the fields of climate change, consulting, impact finance, circular economy, and more about how they've launched their careers and the tips they have for you to join their industries. Visit gps.bard.com.